My name is Ronnie Pareles. I am new to Revel and to YU. Although I lived on the west side while I was doing grad work at NYU downtown, and I lived very close to OZ, and I have many fond memories of this room in particular, and the beautiful sanctuary upstairs. And today we're going to be focusing on an area of Jewish history where there's a lot of mystery, there's a lot of ignorance and confusion, and there's a lot of romanticism related to these figures. When I say crypto-Judaism, often also referred to as Maranos, Maronism, and we're going to get into some of the details of this. But first I want to start with a quote, and this is from Christopher Columbus's the prologue to his diaries. And we'll start with that. Would someone like to read that? Any volunteers? Start your morning off with a public
And thus, after having expelled all the Jews from your kingdoms and possessions in the same month of January, your royal highnesses sent me to these parts of the Indies.
Okay, so here we have Columbus, and he's talking about 1492. 1492 is often referred to, at least in Spanish history, as an Anno Mirabilis, a year of wonders, because of so many eventful happenings happening all at once. The first thing here we have one of the mentionings of one of the great wonders, for us, it wasn't really a very positive wonder, but certainly a cataclysmic happening, which was the expulsion of the Jews. What else happened, according to this? What else is being linked with the expulsion of the Jews? Yes, Columbus's voyage to what he calls the Indies, which until almost the end of his life, he really thought that that's exactly where he was. He assumed that Cuba, the island of Cuba, which is long and thin, was Japan, and that any day he'd be making it to the Great Khan in China. But that's another story for another lecture. But be it that as it may, the precedent for both these acts, Columbus's voyage and the expulsion of the Jews, was another event that happened on the first day of 1492, which was the conquest of Granada. Granada was the last Muslim kingdom in Spain, in the Iberian Peninsula. It was conquered after a very long war, financed to a great extent by Jewish financiers such as the Abravanel. And when that war was over, the Spanish monarchs were able to focus their energies on other projects. And one of their great feelings was that there was a problem in the heart of Spain, which was that we had all these conversos, people who converted over about a 150-year period to Catholicism, but that their purity of faith was being weakened. And the source of that weakness, the source of that infection, was the presence of living, breathing Jews on the Iberian Peninsula who were affecting their former co-religionists and tempting them back to the heretical ways of Judaism. And so the decision was made after much deliberation to expel the Jews. And what is often overlooked is that Spain was really the last country in Western Europe to expel its Jews. All the other countries, all the other kingdoms of Western Europe, England, France, and Germany, did this a long time before. Spain and Portugal, a few years later, were really the last ones to do it in Western Europe. And this started all sorts of very important moves in Jewish history, along with general world history. Today we're going to focus in on the fate of those Jews who stayed behind in the Iberian world, who did not fully assimilate to Catholicism, who stayed a part of Judaism, who kept Judaism on some level in the privacy of their own homes, in the privacy of their own souls, and maintained to different degrees a very vibrant and eclectic form of Judaism. And that's what we're going to be looking at today, is specifically those Jews who leave the Iberian Peninsula and go find refuge and seek new opportunities in the New World. Specifically Mexico today is where we're going to be focusing in on. And if you turn the page, before we read this quote, I just want to just clarify a couple terms. Sephardic, it's a term which today has a very expansive use. Generally speaking, for most Ashkenazim, Sephardic means anyone who's not you, okay? Anyone who, all the people who don't come from Yiddish-speaking communities. Historically, it's a lot more specific. What would be a more exact definition for Sephardic? Something to do with Spain, the Iberian Peninsula, Jews of the Iberian Peninsula and their diasporas, which would mean, historically, would mean Jews who left Spain for Italy, the Ottoman Empire, North Africa, and also to the west, to Amsterdam and later London and Hamburg, and then to the New World in places like Curaçao and Recife, and then eventually right here in the beautiful city of New York, really was New Amsterdam in 1654 when the first open Jewish community was established in North America. So that's Sephardic, and obviously today it has a wider connotation, and there are all sorts of good and not so good reasons for that, and that's another lecture. Converso is the Spanish term for a convert, really a convert to Catholicism, and those Jews who converted to Catholicism, whether under duress or of free will, for a variety of reasons in Spain, really starting from 1391 in a very massive way till 1492, most of them, even generations later, even after any shred of Jewish practice was taken out of them, they were marked sociologically as different. They were marked as conversos into, as strange as it seems, into the late 18th century. We have writers talking about the issue of the conversos and that this person's a Jew and that person's a Jew. And still to this day, if you go to Spain and you meet people and they get a sense that you're Jewish, they will often, depending on where they're from and how they see themselves and their own kind of self-perception, they'll come up to you and they'll confide. They'll say, you know, I'm Jewish. And the person can have a cross around their neck, and you say, what do you mean? And they say, oh, I mean, my father was a doctor, his father was a doctor, we're from Toledo, everyone knows that we were Jewish. It had no content to it, besides certain bizarre sociological, cultural connotations. There are cases of people who did do all sorts of genealogical research, found out that they actually are Jewish. Some of them convert formally, some of them just keep this as a piece of their own sense of identity. But it's an issue which is vibrant and alive, and it's certainly alive in modern day Spanish historiography and even in the tourism industry. The prominent role of the preservation and renovation of old Jewish quarters in all the different small Spanish towns. Remember, the Jews had a very long, long history in the Iberian Peninsula and a very rich, vibrant past, and so that there are all sorts of markers of that, and so it continues. Murano is a pejorative term used to describe crypto-Jews, in other words, Jews who converted to Catholicism and yet maintained some practice or beliefs of Judaism, which was against Catholic principle, and which marked them as heretics. And crypto-Jew is just the more exact term. And Inquisition is the institution of the Catholic Church, which has precedence early on in Catholic history. Whenever there is an act of heresy or the threat of heresy or the suspicion of heresy in a certain place, the local bishop has the obligation to conduct an inquisition, an investigation into this heresy. Jews as Jews are not the focus of the Inquisition. Only to the extent that they participate in helping Catholics commit acts of heresy, or to the extent that they blaspheme the church. But a Jew keeping 613 mitzvot in all their particulars is of no interest to the Inquisition. What is of interest is that someone who was Jewish, converts to Catholicism, and now is part of the body of the church, and who that person now goes back to the dead law of Moses. That is when they fall into the target of the Inquisition. And that's something that should be clarified. So this is just to kind of give a little bit of lay of the land, but I saw a question.
Yeah. That was just my question. In Catholicism or Christianity, a heretic is somebody who is nominally a Christian and who goes against the law, but somebody who is outside, i.e. a Jew, is not a heretic, technically. Is that correct?
Right, a Jew is not, well, a Jew, exactly, is not a, how to, the exact term. What is a Jew? A Jew is an infidel, right? Professor Berger, maybe?
Infidel is also sort of not a technical term in the English language. He was a Jew. I mean, there's one context, there are contexts, which are right very long, in controversy, where things get tricky, where Jews come to the church authorities and show them a book by Maimonides, and they tell them, you know, I'm obviously going to be making up the next sentence, but in effect they tell them, look, you tolerate Jews. That's very nice of you. But that doesn't mean that any person born Jewish can believe anything in Christian Europe. The person has to believe in Judaism to be tolerated. So this is not Christianity or Judaism. This
so it has no place.
By any criterion. So, you know, that made the thing much trickier. But essentially, that's true. I mean, if you're a Christian, then, and you deviate from Christian belief that in a very serious way, then you're a heretic. But a Jew is outside the boundaries to begin with.
Right. And also, just a clarifying point, sin is also not the purview of the Inquisition. If someone sins and says that this is okay, then already he becomes a heretic. In other words, a Christian who doesn't hear Mass, well, he sinned. He didn't hear Mass. But if he says it's okay to not hear Mass, then that's already he's putting himself in a heretical position. Yeah. One more question. We'll continue. Yeah.
How would you classify Spinoza then? Who was
there? You go.
Who was born Jewish? Who may say is an atheist and a heretic.
How
do you classify him? Who didn't convert?
So he had the good fortune he wasn't living in a Catholic country. And he was living in a very unique place. Amsterdam at the time allowed him to be his own person, which he very vigorously. Yes, yes. I believe he was born in Amsterdam, but his parents were Muranos from Portugal, and he grew up in the Jewish community in Amsterdam, and he couldn't stay there. But he also did not convert to Christianity, and so wasn't under the church. So he really lived a very independent life. He was forced out of his family's business, and he took up the career of lens crafter, lens grinder, and that's how he supported himself. And he refused appointments in universities because that would require him to convert to a religion that he didn't believe in either. So Spinoza is a very interesting case, and there's been plenty of excellent, some spurious scholarship about the connection between his converso past and his own more heretical, which is a very rich vein of scholarship. I want to just because I'm afraid with the time, we'll take questions at the end if you can hold on, right? Okay, so that's the setup. I want to just go to this primary source right here, which comes from an inquisitorial trial of someone who left Spain with the expulsion, and as many people found, it was very difficult leaving your homeland. It was very difficult leaving your place where you grew up, where you knew everything, where you had your language, where your family was for hundreds of years. And all of a sudden, you you uproot yourself, you go to a foreign territory where you don't know the language, where you don't have your family contacts, you don't have your ways of supporting yourself, and you find yourself lost, and you go back to your homeland. Would someone like to read this? So this is what this, someone like to read this? Anyone? Back? Like? Yeah. Okay. Thanks. If the king.
Okay. If the king, our Lord, would command the Christians to become Jewish or otherwise leave his kingdom, some of them would become Jewish and others would leave. Those that would leave, finding themselves lost, would turn Jewish in order to return to their nature. And they would be Christians and would pray as Christians and they would fool the world. They, the world, would think that they were Jewish, but on the inside, in their hearts and will, they would be Christians.
So what is this returning Jew, say the inquisitors? He turns the tables on them. He says, you think this is so strange? You think that what we do when we act like Christians on the outside and but really we're Jewish on the inside, you think this is so strange? You think that you wouldn't do the same thing? If everything was inverse, if the world was a mirror of what it is today, and instead of the Catholic monarchs, they would be the Jewish monarchs, and they would force all the Christians of Spain to either leave or become Jewish. You don't think they do the same thing. And it's a very powerful retort. And I just wanted to just point out a few terms which really survive in general contours of the phenomenology of crypto-Judaism. So first of all, the idea of nature, that there's something on the inside which can be different than what things seem on the outside, and that the world can be fooled, right? They would pray as Christians, and they would fool the world, right? And there's acknowledgement that the world as it stands, society, is an external construct, and what really matters is what's inside. And this is a belief that crypto-Jews, you find in many, many cases of crypto-Jews who state this, and who after those of them who are able to leave, when they come to Judaism, come to open Jewish communities, this is how they see themselves. They see that they're in their core, they were doing what they were living as Jews, and what was going on the outside, whatever practices they had to keep in order to maintain their bodies alive, that was secondary. And this is something which they shared with some of the very radical spiritualist movements that were popular in Spain in the 16th century. Movements that coincidentally or not, were often headed by conversos who were looking for a more spiritual Christianity, a Christianity that wasn't focused on the externalities of practice and ritual, but rather focusing on the spirit, on the inner dimensions of the inner psychology of the person, and dimensions of prayer and acts of kindness, as opposed to the outward trappings of Christianity. And so we see these interesting parallels between conversos who were not trying to be Jewish, but were looking for a more spiritual Christianity, and conversos who were actually trying to be Jewish, trying to figure out Judaism on their own terms in this very compromised situation. And that's where we're going to focus right now, which is, how is it all the Jews leave? Right? There are no more, there's no one to do Mila, there's no one to do Shechita, there's no one to teach you, there are no Hebrew books, because those are banned. There's no one to teach you Hebrew anyways. And all Jewish books dealing with Judaism, are also prohibited. So how do you live as a Jew if you're living in Spain or you're living in another part of the Spanish-speaking world at the time where it's prohibited? How do you live as a Jew? How do you know what to do? How do you know what to pray? How do you know when to keep your holidays? How do you know what the holidays are? And this is a question that historians of this phenomenon have asked, and we find fascinating clues to how Jews who wanted in this compromised situation to maintain their Judaism kept their Judaism. Any ideas? How would you do it? Everyone, all the open Jews left, and whatever Judaism you're going to keep has to be in secret, and and uh, and and well guarded, what would you do?
Make a new religion?
Okay, how would that look? Yeah.
Education to children, primary, like sort of like a Torah Shabbat pen, you know, all oral.
Okay, oral. The orality of crypto-Judaism is very important. One of the greatest ways that we see that orality is that by the second generation, like a game of telephone, it's very garbled. Things are conflated, and certainly whatever, most Hebrew words are, you need to be very creative when you read between however it was orally pronounced and then written down by the inquisitorial secretary, how many things are going to be very garbled, and practices themselves are going to become twisted. But the orality is very important, oral tradition, whatever they remembered. What did you remember your grandparents doing before 1492? Very good. What else? Yeah? Okay, so keep doing things in a secret way. One of the things that you start seeing is that as opposed to normative Judaism, where the synagogue is a central location of religious life, for tefillah, for study, what happens in crypto-Judaism is that the home becomes the center because you can hide things. And so women's roles become very important. Cooking, preparing food, all these areas where women can women have a very important role, and keeping things in a secret way, so you can do Seder, right? You just have to be very careful who you invite, and how you do it, and when you do it, and where you do it, the home becomes this very important site. Any others? Yeah.
Have things look like they're Christian, but intersperse the outside Christian physicality with the inside Jewish model.
Okay, excellent. In other words, have a dichotomy between your what you're actually doing and the kavanah you bring to that act, which for sure. There's a film called, I don't remember the exact name, but it's about the Jews of Belmonte, Portugal, in the small town in north of Portugal. Into the early part of the 20th century, there were Jews living in this town who lived as though the Inquisition was alive and well. They completely married amongst themselves, kept their practices. Everyone in the town knew that they were the Jews. And one of this community in the 20s, became a very famous general in the Portuguese army and was living in the city. And he decided, you know, this is enough is enough. And we need to come out of our closets, literally, and join the rest of the world. And he started that. But into the 60s, people were still, you know, many of the practices were still alive and well. There's one section of the film where one of the women goes to the church, and she shows the filmmaker what she says before she goes into the church, which is basically a formula, which basically says, God, and she uses the term Adonai, she says, I know this is not your house. This is just a house of wood and stone. And that's how she goes to the church, and that's how she leaves. So we see this. We have certain remnants of that for sure. One other? Anyone else? We have orality. We have domesticity. Yeah.
I imagine at the most internal level, it's mentally, that even if you were someone who is constantly watched, then you could just perform whatever actions you do and just go through the motions and just know internally, you know, I have no interest in this, or I'm just performing it, but I don't believe it.
Right. Right, so that works for when you need to be going out, and need to go to Mass and show that you went to Mass, and that can you can maybe have some sort of mental reservation that you can know that inside. But we know that Judaism is a religion of acts, and that even in crypto-Judaism, where so much emphasis was placed on belief, where ultimately the only reason why someone was often considered by the Inquisition or by themselves as Jewish, because they... a slight change in words. Instead of saying that they believe that they will be saved in the law of Jesus, rather, they believe that they would be saved in the law of Moses. And without much to do with what they did or didn't do. But when it comes to actual practices, so we know that still, crypto-Judaism also cared about practices, and so there was the oral piece, but how do you know? How do you know what to do, when to do it? So we're going to look at one piece, and this is from the life of the autobiography of Luis de Carvajal. Luis de Carvajal was a crypto-Jew who was born in Spain, 1567, left with his family in 1580 to Mexico, and lived in Mexico till his death in 1596. And he died in an auto de fe in Mexico City after being convicted a second time of Judaizing, which is the crime of practicing, of a Christian who practices Judaism. So we're going to read one of the early sections in his autobiography that he writes down before his second arrest, describing how he discovered the mitzvah of circumcision. Okay? So, any readers? Okay.
Reading one day in chapter 17 of Genesis, where the Lord commanded Abraham, our holy father, to circumcise himself.
I'm sorry, just one thing. I forgot to backtrack a little bit. A few lines before, and I should have put it in there, I'm sorry. A few lines before, he describes how on a trip from Mexico City to where his family is living in a small frontier area close to the Gulf of Mexico, he runs into a priest who he is able to buy a Latin Bible from. Now, Luis had the distinction that he knew Latin. When he was a child, he was sent to a very good Jesuit school, and so he had Latin, which allowed him to read all sorts of things, which most people at the time were not able to. And he was able to get a Bible. A Bible, even in Latin, was not something that every person had in their home. It was not encouraged in the Catholic world to read the Bible, as opposed to the Protestant world. So Bibles were a commodity. And Luis gets his hands on this Bible. He describes the purchase of the Bible as something which God ordained for it to happen for him. And so he says that he came home and he just started reading and he basically did not stop. He opened the book and he was alone one day and just went from the beginning to the end. So here he is, he's reading, and as we know, you know, the famous question of Rashi at the beginning of the Chumash, why do we have all this? Why don't we, you know, we should go all the way, L'chodesh hazeh lechem. Well, so for Luis, he almost had that same question. You know, why do I really care about all these other stories when what I really need to know is what I need to do? And he finally gets it in chapter 17. So if you can continue. Thank you.
Especially those words which say the soul which would be circumcised will be erased,
uncircumcised.
Will be uncircumcised. Will be erased from the will be erased from the book of living. It gave him, Luis, a shock of fear that without any delay he betook himself with the execution of the divine inspiration, moved by the Most High and by his good angel, and in this way he picked himself up from where he was reading in the house, and even leaving the Holy Bible open, he took some blunted and worn scissors, and he went to the banks of the Panuco River, where with great zeal and burning desire to be inscribed into the Book of Life, which without his holy sacrament it is impossible, he cut himself and placed the seal upon his flesh.
So this is how Luis found out about circumcision. And so a couple things here. First of all, a word about circumcision in the Iberian world. Circumcision... already with Paul, one of the great points of polemics that Paul had with Judaism, and one of the ways he really tried to separate, cut off Judaism from Christianity, was talking about many of the ritual mitzvot in general, but one of the particular targets of his polemic was circumcision. Because he says, you know, what we really want isn't circumcision of the flesh, but rather circumcision of the heart. Okay, very good. That's what God wants. And now that there's Jesus and we can attain grace, we don't need the physical laws. And people who focus on those physical laws, their hearts will be stopped up, right? They will be blind. They will live only holding on to the flesh and not getting the spirit. And this is a, you know, a classic element in the Christian-Jewish debate. And so for that reason, in Christianity, circumcision is not, certainly in Catholicism, to circumcise your child or yourself for religious reasons. I mean, if you're going to make an argument about health or it's needed for medical reasons, that's a totally different issue. But again, going back to the definition of heresy, to do it for religious reasons, to say, oh, because the Bible says I'm supposed to do it, that is an act of heresy for a Christian to do so. Now, there's another element about circumcision which would make it an act which most crypto-Jews would never, ever perform. What is it?
It's
identifiable. You can't cover it up. In fact, part of when someone was suspected of Judaism, they would be brought in front of the inquisitors, and there would be a surgeon who would inspect them if they were male. And so it was, there was no way to go around it. To circumcise yourself, knowing that you were going to continue living in the Iberian world, where you'd be watched and the consequences would be very high, was an act of extreme, extreme bravery or stupidity or, you know, however you want to put it. But it marks you in a way that there's no going back. And for that reason, it was very rare to find people who were continuing to live in the Iberian world. You'd only have cases, what you do have are cases of people who either were born Jewish and then converted, which you have in the first generation, or you have people who left Spain, went to Italy or Amsterdam, became part of the Jewish community, were circumcised, and then go back, right? They return to the Iberian world for a number of reasons. We have many, many cases like this. This was a widespread phenomenon, mostly for economic reasons, and were caught. So that's just to give a bit of the background here. Now, when you look at this text, this is one of the ways that crypto-Jews who were educated were able to learn about Judaism, by going to texts which were available in limited quantities, such as Christian Bibles, using Christian tools like Latin to be able to read it, because there were no vernacular Bibles that were permitted. So any ones that were underground, so to speak, and prohibited. So by using Latin, which he learned in a Catholic school, he was able to navigate this text and find what he needed to find. Right? Disregard the New Testament part, focus on the Hebrew part, and get what he needed to know. But yet, when we look at this text, what sort of Christian markers do we find? What do you find here that's clearly a... doesn't sound very Jewish. Where's that?
Right.
And something that's seen a lot is things like all the prophets are referred to as Saint so-and-so. Saint David, Saint Daniel, Saint Esther. Which is obviously a holdover from his Catholic milieu. What else? Yeah.
Use the word sacrament.
Yes, exactly. That's the big one. That's the big one here. I mean, there are other ones here which are interesting, but the sacrament idea is central, right? The Catholic Church has certain sacraments. If you don't get them, if you don't get all the sacraments, then what's going to happen to you when you die? You won't go to heaven. Doesn't matter. You save the world. What?
Dogmas.
Well, the dogma is right. We'll make you a heretic if you don't believe them. But the sacraments, if you do not receive those sacraments, you are not going to get to heaven. The circumcision is not that, right? Circumcision is an oath. It's the covenant. But the terms of sacrament is an imported term. And yes, to be an arel really does limit or put you in a lower category, negative category, but it's certainly not the same thing.
What's the seal upon his flesh? What's that
metaphor? Well, that's oath. You know, it's the oath. Yeah. Right, and the brit. So oath brit. So this is one way to figure it out. I want to pass out another way that we know that crypto-Jews learned about Judaism. Take one and pass it around. This is It's an edict of faith. Edict of faith is what, when the Inquisition was coming to a certain locale to investigate, before investigating, they would declare a period of grace. These edicts of faith were also called edicts of grace. They're interchangeable. Because they would post in public places, put up broadsides, declaring that the Inquisition was coming to town, and if anyone practiced or knew of someone who practiced any of the following things, then they have a period now to go and present themselves in front of the inquisitors and come clean, confess, or point your finger at someone who you know was doing it. And if you do that, then you're fine, right? You won't be investigated. You won't have any problems. If you don't, then you'll be, and you're suspected, then you're going to be in trouble when you go before the inquisitors. So if you go to the second page.
Can I ask, did we honor that? In other words, if you owned up to the fact that you had been doing the eye thing, they left you up. I mean, then what happened?
I mean, it'd be a very minor penance, you know, because then you can make the claim, oh, I had no idea. Now, thank you for telling me. This is the point. You need to let people know what is Judaizing. In other words, the church acknowledged that a person could make the claim. That's just what we do. You know, as you'll see, some of these practices, many of them could clearly just kind of blend in with what, you know, just that's what you do. You put on a clean shirt on Friday. I didn't know that had anything to do with Judaism. You know, I didn't know that if you put a pot on the stove Friday afternoon and you wait till Saturday afternoon to eat it, that's a Jewish practice. And we're going to see that's something in here. So let's just read a few. Just look to yourselves quickly. If you look here through some of these lists, right? If any of you has seen or heard say that any person or persons have kept any Sabbaths in honor of the rules of the law of Moses, and look through a few of these things. Any of these look familiar to you?
This is what the mothers in Brooklyn make sure that the Chassan's parents do.
Yes, that they know, they make sure. The white tablecloth, huh? Now, some of these things you may not recognize. Again, this is the reflection of a mixture of the garbled nature of the oral tradition, and also of sometimes the inquisitors not knowing anything about Judaism. Sometimes they know a lot, and sometimes they don't know very much. So what are some things that scream out as normative Jewish practices? And what are some things that are maybe a little bit interesting? Okay. Yeah.
It's interesting that they can do like low tax days also, because how can they know if you're not doing something?
Yeah. Like what? What's an example?
If not going away then.
Right. Right.
Oh,
okay.
I didn't know that. I think that's easier. I actually was thinking that would be the easiest thing. Somebody who doesn't go out in their field. That, you know, you have all these farmers. You're not. Yeah. Who doesn't farm on a Friday?
Uh-huh.
Or Saturday. You know.
Right.
What I'm saying?
Okay.
That would be the easiest.
Right. Seeing someone who's refraining from doing what everyone else does.
Everybody goes out.
Uh-huh. Right. Except that you can, in some circumstances, you can just say, well, I just wasn't in the mood, or I was too cheap to light a light at night, or, yeah.
What about that Mexican one where if your mother sweeps in the wrong direction, they don't know it's Jewish? What is that?
The modern 20th century crypto-Jewish phenomenon in the Southwest is its own, I think has to be treated somewhat separate from a lot of this. It's another lecture, honestly. It's its own situation. So a lot of those things that people know about, it's very popular, but it's its own, deserves its own treatment. So we see things about shechita, we see things about salting, Shabbat, all sorts of things. Fasts are very important for many crypto Jews. Some historians have want to say that the guilt that they sensed for their continual observance of Catholicism induced them to try to counteract that with engaging in fast. So often their fast will be for 3 days, and fasts are very important, much more so than feasts. Also, a fast, you can make the claim, oh, no, I'm just not hungry right now. Or, yeah, the doctor told me that I need to fast. things of that nature. Which medical excuses, if they were bona fide, were a really good way to avoid being condemned by the Inquisition. This was true of, you know, for instance, someone who was eating, who seemed to be eating meat during Lent, right? Or meat on Fridays, which are things that Catholics don't do or shouldn't do. If you can say, oh, my doctor told me I need to eat meat because I have a condition, so then that would get you off. So, curiously enough, these edicts of faith were a very important guide after a certain point to Jews who wanted to keep Judaism. Because they could go look up and see, oh, that's what you do. And it seems, I mean, it's wonderfully counterintuitive and you know, almost, it's very ironic and funny to imagine this. It's not so uncommon. In the history of heresy, often the only way we know about heresies anymore is by the people who were trying to destroy the heresy, right? So many of the great, because their own works, either they never wrote it down because they didn't want to be found out, or their books were burnt, but we can still find out about the heresy through the people who were trying to destroy them, who wrote how terrible they are and all the things they did. And then it's a question of how you read them, and that's, I guess, what historians are paid for. So, yeah, before we move on to the next source, anything about that?
Yeah. That you mentioned, it looks like Tisha B'Av.
Yeah.
Is it different?
No, it's Tisha B'Av. It's just, you know, enough times, again, it's telephone. That's my reading of it. That doesn't, you know, enough times saying Tisha B'Av without knowing what Tisha B'Av means, you'll start saying all sorts of, you know, it'll start being all sorts of words. So. What?
The 10 little lights on Hanukkah?
Yeah. You know, exactly. There are a lot of things like that, that things are just strange or different things which become very central, which you've never even heard of, right. Things get garbled with time. Now the last, depending on our time, we have till 12, right? Yeah, okay. So this may be the second to last, all right, is a fascinating example. So we just looked at two two basic, you know, one we looked at the oral, we looked at the navigating of a Christian text. Another piece of that navigation of Christian text, which Luis de Carvajal was an expert at, was reading Christian polemical works, again, anti-Jewish polemical works, against the grain. Or what the French theorist Michel de Certeau refers to as poaching a text. Going in and taking what you want from it and forgetting about the rest. And Luis Carvajal was a fantastic poacher. He, after his first prison stint in prison with the Inquisition, part of his penance and in the hope of him really being reformed, he was put to work in a church school. And it was a fascinating church school. It was a place in Mexico City called the School of Indians at Tlatelolco. And it was a place designed to teach the children of the Aztec nobility, to teach them Latin, to basically educate the next generation of indigenous leaders in the church. And Luis, with his great Latin, was put there to teach Latin to these Indians. And along the way, he was discovered for his great penmanship, and he was put to work as the scribe for the rector of the school. And he describes this rector in very glowing terms, a very kindly man, a saintly person. And for him, the greatest thing about this job was that he had hours to himself in the library copying books and reading them and discovering them and creating his own books from them. And he describes how he would read these classic medieval commentaries, which in the medieval mode would quote verbatim large tracts of a text and then comment on them. And so the fact that the commentator was quoting the Rambam in very extensive passages, only to then spend a longer passage destroying him, or trying to undo and criticize every aspect of it, didn't matter to Luis, because what mattered to Luis was, I'm reading the Rambam. No one in Mexico ever heard of the Rambam. No one ever read the 13 principles. And he says that exact phrase. He says, in these lands, no one has ever heard of this. And here he is, able to read it, on the side, copy it, and he created these own kind of textbooks out of these assorted works of Christian anti-Jewish, often polemics. And so through that really created his own eclectic Jewish curriculum for himself and for others, because he would copy it again and spread it around and share it with the other crypto-Jews that he was a part of. And so these are kind of the more illicit forms of text trafficking that crypto-Jews were involved in. But there was a more standard way, which was through Jewish books. And you would say, well, how did a Jewish book arrive? Obviously, there would be some books in people's homes that would be passed down, but those were dangerous to hold on to, and often there were very few of them. But there was something else, which, although it was dangerous to hold on to it, came from outside. And once you're living like Luis de Carvajal, you're living on the edge. You circumcise yourself. You're keeping secret sedarim out in the Mexican countryside with other crypto Jews. You're doing all sorts of behavior that any one of them could trip off the authorities and you. And unfortunately, which is what happened, all of your network of other crypto Jews will be found out. But one of the curious things about crypto Judaism, and one of the reasons why it was managed to maintain itself and to survive, was that it wasn't fully cut off from normative Judaism. The Iberian world was, as you look at the map at the beginning, between Spain and Portugal, you had most of the then known world, right? The newly discovered world. You had all of the Americas, exception of a couple cold coastlines in the north that no one really cared about except some Puritans that had nowhere else to go, meaning where we live. You had the islands, many colonies in the Far East, Spice Islands, Goa, and certainly colonies throughout the coast of Africa. And so world trade was, on some level, centered in the Iberian world. And the Jews who moved to places like Venice, places like Amsterdam, where the lifeblood of those communities was trade, international trade, used their contacts in the Iberian Peninsula and throughout the Iberian colonies to maintain their businesses, and often would find themselves going to Mexico, going to the Caribbean, going to the Spice Islands, on business. And along the way, while doing business, they'd leave a sidur in Spanish or Portuguese. They would leave a chumash, translated with a commentary, again, in vernacular, in Spanish or Portuguese. And they would leave it behind so that other people can benefit. And while they're there, they would teach. They would teach people, no, we don't do it that way. We do it this way. And we have evidence of these individuals. Some of them get caught. Some of them leave without a trace, except for the communities that they were a part of. And that's the last text that we'll look at. And this is, again, from Luis de Carvajal, talking about an Italian Jew who comes to Mexico. Curiously enough, he comes with a patent from the Vatican allowing him to collect alms. Now, he was a Jew, Portuguese Jew, who was living in an Italian ghetto, was broke, came up with this idea that if he goes to the Vatican and gets a patent, a license to collect alms as a poor, indigent Catholic, he can maybe make some money and, I guess, see the world. And this is what he does. He shows up to the Vatican as a Catholic, gets his license, goes first to Spain, and then goes to Mexico, and while in Mexico, makes money by teaching these crypto Jews all about Judaism. And he leaves. He leaves a sidur. He leaves a chumash. It's him and his son. And he's not alone. There are other examples of this, pretty outrageous behavior. And here we see Luis describing this. And we'll just get a sense of what it was like for living cut off and yet aware that there's this other normative, thriving Jewish community somewhere else. The Lord again performed acts of mercy for them, referring to himself and his brother. providing them with many of the sacred and devout prayers with which the Lord is invoked and praised in the Israelite synagogues by the wise people, the chosen ecclesia of the Lord. Again, Christian terminology. The church, kehilah, right? The means through which His Holiness brought this good thing from our brothers, who live free to observe the law of the Most High God without restrictions to the lands of His captivity, was through a servant of His, one of those who live in the diaspora of Italy. And this is the person that I was describing. But here we have Luis, who describes his situation as living in the lands of captivity. But he knows that elsewhere, Judaism is alive and well. And his goal is eventually to get there. His goal in writing down this life story was so that it would be sent to one of his brothers who already made it to Italy, so that the Jews of the world will know of all the acts of kindness, the miracles, the wonders that God performed for his humble servant, Luis de Carvajal, in Mexico. And unfortunately, he was caught just months before he was about to embark to Italy. And his life ended up in flames. But until that point, we have an amazing evidence of the tenacity and the intensity of Jewish practice, and searching out in all sorts of ways to try to revitalize this Judaism, which was eventually suffocated in many other places. But we know that when many Jews who were living in the Iberian world make it to open Jewish communities in Amsterdam, in Italy, in the Ottoman Empire, in North Africa, we know that not all of them came as complete Amiarites. Many of them came with knowledge of Judaism from very bizarre, strange sources. And part of the challenge of those communities was to integrate these people into open normative Judaism. And this is just one case of it. So it's been an honor to share this journey with you.
All right.
And I think we have time for one question, maybe? One question? Okay, yeah.
You focus on the Inquisition as being a detection of Jews who had originally converted to Christianity. But the historical antecedent back in 1391-1392 as a 100-year, my understanding was like a 100-year warning. Like the Jews had it. There was 100 years by which the Jews had to either get out or to convert.
No. No. In 1391, there were mass violent riots against the Jews. Many Jews converted under duress. And afterwards, despite the fact that it was done under duress, which is against church protocol, they were considered Jews. And they were given a reprieve. The Inquisition was not going to look into their affairs for a certain amount of time. But the rest of the Jewish community was not at all given the sense that they needed to leave or convert.
Wasn't there an edict that was issued in 1392 by the chief Catholic priest who actually was a convert himself from Judaism? That's my understanding.
Saying that the Jews either have to convert or leave, have 100 years to convert or leave?
Yes.
I never seen that. And really, if you look at the deliberations surrounding the expulsion, you see that the monarchs tried everything. I mean, one way to read that is to say that they really did try everything to solve the converso-Jewish problem without expelling all the Jews. They first expelled Jews from Andalusia, and then it still was a problem. And so, it was a really progressive situation. Yes, they put pressure on Jews. They forced them to hear sermons in the synagogues, things of that sort. But I'm not aware of that. If you find that, send it to me. I'd love to see it. And you can, my email is, you can find me at the website. Okay.